Hello and welcome to the LRM podcast, sponsored by Adrian Flux Insurance. I'm Martin Dominey, and today I'm privileged to be joined by the designer of the Discovery One and the Range Rover Sport, Mike Sampson. Thank you for joining me, Mike.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, the reason we're here, I suppose, really is, and this chance encounter we've had is because we're here to look at the Car SOS Discovery One, which they've just finished, which is absolutely stunning. And I believe Tim Shaw roped you in to sort of do a bit to camera about it and to chat to the guys about how it came about. Is that right?
Yes, it was a kind of chance encounter. I don't know exactly where he got my name from. But I received an email saying, he wanted to get in touch as one of the designers on the original Discovery. And I foolishly agreed to do it.
Well, I wouldn't say foolishly. I think it's been a really nice day so far. And looking around it and hearing straight from the horse's mouth, if you like, about some of the design cues on the car's just been fantastic.
Yeah, I have to agree, actually. I am joking. It's... It has been a completely new experience for me, although I've watched the program Car SOS on many occasions and seen many of the cars they've rebuilt. I never sort of anticipated that I would ever get involved in something like that, but it has been a great experience and great fun.
Yes, it's been really nice to see someone who was so involved with it back then sort of, the enthusiasm is still there and like all those memories coming back of what the job you were doing at the time. So can you tell us a little bit more about how that came about and what you actually had to do with the design of the car?
It came about really, I suppose, when I joined Land Rover, which was I think way back in 1983, which seems like another lifetime. The 110 had just come out. 190, I think, was in the death throes of being released. And, of course, there was the Range Rover Classic, which had become a five-door from a three-door vehicle. And the company were scratching their heads about what to do for something in between the Land Rover, which is, of course, better known as Defender these days, and Range Rover, because Range Rover was moving gradually upwards in terms of its market, with more creature comforts in it. Land Rover Defender was where it always was, a farmer's vehicle, a useful utility vehicle. And there was this ever-widening gap that we needed to plug. We first looked at a project known as Capricorn on the Defender 90, Land Rover 90, which included forward-facing rear seats, but it really didn't quite do it. It wasn't enough. So the idea was pointed that maybe we could do something using the Range Rover Classic frame and chassis and develop a new vehicle from that, which is where Discovery started from, really.
Wow. Okay. Of course, Discovery, sort of, you only have to glance underneath a Discovery One to see the similarities between that and a Range Rover. But exactly, the real sort of the meat of it, really, the design challenges, I guess, and the development was in that body shell and the interior, I suppose, to make it that little bit more sort of family friendly, I guess you could say.
Yeah, very much so. We wanted to make the most useful vehicle in the world, I suppose, that was all things to all people and was fit for so many different purposes, I suppose. At that time when we started it, we were still quite a small team led by David Evans, who was the studio chief at the time. George Thompson was in charge of exteriors and Alan Mobley interiors, and I worked with George on the exterior, along with another designer, Dick Bartlam, and the three of us were really hands-on all the time on the exterior of Discovery One.
Wow. So really only three people were sort of responsible for the way it looks.
Pretty much, yeah.
That's
yeah.
crazy to think now, like car design companies now and what
you need thousands of people.
An enormous team. That's incredible. Yeah. So pardon my ignorance, I've never had much to do with car design. Where do you even start when it comes to putting a vehicle like that sort of to paint? Does it start in paper and then develops, you know, as you go along? Or,
well, you usually start with a package which gives you the basic sort of layout of the vehicle, where the axles are, so you know what your wheelbase is, and you're generally given roughly what the front overhang is and what the rear overhang is, because of engine and transmission packaging and seating packaging and those sort of things. But for Discovery, it was almost a little bit easier because you've got a Range Rover frame. So everything was there that you were going to build this vehicle upon. The real trick, I suppose, was how do we make it not look like a Range Rover? How
yeah.
do we get something completely different from underpinnings which are belonging to another vehicle?
Okay. Obviously, the Range Rover has that famous sort of overhang behind the back wheel.
Yes.
But when you look at a Discovery, it doesn't look nearly as long. And I guess, I mean, we just chatted to Tim and Fuzz, and they were saying that you basically hid the back of the chassis rail inside the bumper.
Exactly that, yeah.
It's a stroke of genius, really.
Well, we were just looking at ways of doing it, and we knew the chassis had still got to be the same length. And we thought, how can we disguise that? So we shortened the body, which, when you think about it, Range Rover Classic had the spare wheel on the inside, vertically upright. So that almost determined what the rear overhang was.
Right, okay.
So we had to put the spare wheel somewhere else. So we thought, well, if we put it on the back door, we've got to shorten the body, and the spare wheel can sit over where the chassis rails are, and we've got a shorter vehicle, but with a function of having the spare wheel on the back. So all these little kind of requirements helped you to design yourself into that particular point.
Got you. Okay. And of course, the Discovery, known for its enormous load capacity, helped no doubt by the height of the boot, because of, you know, from the outset, it always had a stepped roof, so more height, yes, at the back, yeah, than the front.
Yeah.
And that's something that they've sort of tried to continue on to the latest model, but it was certainly the most pronounced with the Discovery 1 and 2.
Yeah, and that was brought about really by the rear seating, because the rear seats are slightly higher than the front seats, what we call stadium seating. And then we'd got the side-facing occasional seats in the back, which gave you a height that you'd got to work to in terms of where the roof was, so that somebody could sit in there comfortably. So that determined that for us. It was really how you got from the front of the roof to the back of the roof with a Defender, a Land Rover. It's a single slope, and then you've got a flat piece of roof behind it. And we wanted to do something to differentiate Discovery from the Land Rover. So hence the step.
Makes total sense.
Yeah.
So one thing that's always kind of puzzled me, and I don't know if there's a reason for it, and hopefully you'll be able to tell me, why didn't they launch a five-door from the outset?
I think it was perhaps a little bit of uncertainty, not knowing where this vehicle or how this vehicle would perform.
Okay.
The marketing assumptions when we first embarked on it was that we would build probably 300 a week Discoveries. And I know for a fact that within a very short time, once production started, we're up to 1,900.
Wow.
So in terms of tooling, I think they wanted to keep that as a minimum and go for the cheapest option that there was, doing a three-door.
Right, okay. And now, of course, those three doors, similar to the one that... That's actually quite a late 200, isn't it?
It is, yeah.
But still the three-door body style, which is now quite sought after because people love that sort of the pure look of the
shape.
There
is a purity about it. It's uncluttered and... it's just something nice about it. And I suppose when you think back, Range Rover was always a three-door.
Yeah, true.
Until sort of into the 80s when it became a fully-fledged five-door and never looked back.
No, I suppose it's that. Depends what you're using it for, doesn't it? It's for families, I guess. Even though it might seem odd that the three door was launched and you could have seven seats in it, it was kind of like you were like taking a journey from the front door all the way to the back to sit in those pop down the dicky seats in the boot.
Well, actually, you always got in through the back door.
Of course, that's
but nevertheless, yeah, I do take your point there, and that is somewhat questionable.
The other thing, of course, you were responsible for was designing the steel wheels on Discoveries.
Yeah, on that first vehicle, I got the job of doing that. We had some new alloy wheels for the vehicle, of course, which were, you know, quite refreshing. But there was a requirement for a steel wheel, and because of the loads that it had to carry, and because of the usage of the vehicle, it meant that the centre of the vehicle, the centre of the wheel, was 8 millimetres thick, which is quite a thick piece of steel, and you can't press much detail into that. So we came up with an idea of a fairly sort of plain wheel, I suppose, but it works. It suits the vehicle, and I'm still very happy about it. Seeing those wheels on the vehicle today, in such good condition, in fresh paint, they just look as fresh and as fitting for purpose as they did all those years ago, I think.
Absolutely. I was shocked and, you know, pleasantly surprised to see that, because you don't often see them. It sounds horrible,
no,
but don't often see them like refurbished like alloy wheels get. They don't tend to get that kind of
everybody wants to put an alloy on the car.
But that Windjammer blue with the three-door body style and the steel wheels ties together so beautifully, and I can really see where they, you know, where you guys were heading with the design back there. It just works so, and it's understated as well. It doesn't shout. A really, really stunning thing to look at.
There's nothing there that doesn't need to be there, and the whole thing is very simple and pure, I think.
Absolutely. The one of the other things you were telling me you had a hand in was the front grille design.
Yeah.
Which was a sort of evolution kind of what was happening, what was on the Range Rover, but you changed it enough to be, you know, give the Discovery a whole new face, I suppose.
Well, it had to be different. Range Rover had recently changed for the Aquila and Eagle programs, I think. When Range Rover went into North America, it got a new front end and a 5-bar horizontal grille. And we wanted something different. We couldn't do the same, so we thought, well, let's go for less bars, because it's a more utility, slightly more utility vehicle. So we went for 3 bars, and I made them chunkier than they were on Range Rover because I thought it suited the vehicle a lot more. But it wasn't different enough, just 3 bars. You thought, well, okay, it's just a 3-bar grille. It's nothing clever about that. So integral to the bumper design, which has got overriders around the number plate plinths, we just took those overriders further up and put them on the grille as well. So there was a tie-in between the grille and the bumper, and somehow it kind of worked.
It certainly does work. And I think until you hear it explained, like how that process came about, you just assume that had been designed from scratch and it was, you know, just meant to be there from the outset. But can we talk a little bit about timescales? And obviously the Discovery one is sort of famous for having parts from previous vehicles. It's like the Marina door handles and the lights and things like that. How did that all sort of happen?
I think it was because it was an extremely tight budget. There was next to no money available. And it was a quick program. We did it in, I think, 18 months.
Wow.
It's one of the fastest programs you'd ever come across, and a lot of that is borne out by the fact that you'd got a chassis and you got a body frame which were tried and tested, so you didn't have to do a huge amount of development on that. It was really in the body itself and the interior where all the work was done. But in terms of budget, that really made us search for parts bin components just to help us out. And wherever you look on the vehicle, you will see those. The headlamps came from the LD Sherpa van. They're square because Range Rover had round lamps, so we wanted something that looked different and took it away from there, and that worked for us. The door handles, as you say, were on the Marina, an Austin Rover parts bin theft. Things like the rear lamps were on the Maestro van, but a lot of these things actually gave us some of the character that you associate with Discovery these days. The chamfered Maestro lamps, rear lamps, gave us the chamfered rear corners on the vehicle, which is a huge part of its character.
It worked
for us.
Something I learned today actually was how that design came about was based off the fact that the light was already chamfered, and you don't even think about
you don't question it. And as I was saying in the interview with Tim earlier, one of the things that does for us is that with the plan shape of the vehicle, because from front three quarters, you just see the front of that chamfered edge. So you assume the vehicle ends there. So it makes it look a lot shorter than it actually is, because you don't see the rear bumper and you don't see the rest of the back end. From front three quarters, it looks quite a short vehicle.
Yeah.
And we do the same thing on the front end with the Sherpa lights. They're kind of at an angle. They're chamfered. So it shortens the front end as well. So from rear three quarter, you just see that corner where the indicator is, and it's a lot further back than the front of the car. So it makes the car look a lot shorter.
We're proud to partner with Adrian Flux, an insurance broker that specialises in covering all types of Land Rovers, including classic, ex-military, modified and Q-plated models. Adrian Flux offers a range of optional extras to make the policy your own and can provide cover for off-roading, green laning, agreed value and build-up cover. Plus, they even offer a discount of up to 15% for Owners Club members. Simply search Adrian Flux Land Rover Insurance for more information, or call them directly on 0344 728 0417 for a quote.
Okay, so as well as Discovery, you are responsible for Range Rover Sport.
Yeah, the very first Range Rover Sport back in, which came out in 2005, I think it was.
Yes, yeah. I remember I did my work experience at the Land Rover dealer in 2006, and they'd just come out, and I was all over them. They're absolutely like nothing else we'd ever seen. Obviously shared a bit of architecture with Discovery 3, but to look at, just so imposing.
Mm.
We were chatting to Paul earlier about the split tailgate setup. Is there anything else in there that sticks on your mind from designing that?
I think, for me, it was a little bit like Discovery, only the other way round, because as we know, Discovery came from Range Rover Classic. Range Rover Sport came from Discovery, because it was based around the LR3 program at the time, and we were instructed that we had to have 60%. Commonality between LR3 and the Range Rover Sport. So as you can imagine, that's a little bit of a challenge.
Absolutely. And
I think it was a similar kind of challenge to Discovery 1, trying to get something completely different out of something else. And we were running, if I remember correctly, 5 months behind the Discovery program. So everything they were doing, you know, we were taking a very keen look at to make sure we could make it work for us as well.
Wow.
Things like, just as a for instance, the scuttle panel where the wipers are, and on the interior all the heater and everything else is mounted to, we had to carry over exactly what it was on Discovery. And Discovery has got a steeper windscreen than Range Rover Sport. So we had to keep, I think it was the first 90 millimetres of the Discovery windscreen, the lower part of it, before we could actually speed the angle up for Range Rover Sport and make it a faster windscreen.
Wow. Yeah, you'd never know to look at them now, would you? It's like
you would never pick up on that.
Incredibly subtly done. So what was the brief? What were you asked to design when that car came about?
Well, that's another funny one, really, because it's the program started under BMW ownership. We were looking at a Discovery replacement, and there were two programs running side by side. One was for a 5-seat and the other was for a 7-seat. So there was a big one and a little one. And we just could not make it work. And in the meantime, we got sold to Ford, who picked it up. And we sort of milled around with it, and we were still looking at this 5-seat and 7-seat. And I cannot remember who it was, but somebody one day said, what if it wasn't a 5-seat Discovery? What if it was a baby Range Rover?
Wow.
And certainly for me personally, I look back on it as a sort of light bulb moment. You know, the light went on and I thought, I could do that. We could do that. And it was a little bit forgotten. I was sort of working away in the corner with a clay model, and I had a couple of modelers with me, and we were messing about with it and just exploring ideas. And the first thing I came up with was a three-door vehicle, a very short three-door, which was really taking all its cues from the original Range Rover Classic.
Right.
I thought, let's go back and have a look at that. And I even put a grille with vertical slots in it just to push that and see, does it fly? Is it something that would work? But it didn't. And that gradually got lengthened a little bit, and it became, we're still looking at it as a three-door, but with kind of one-and-a-half-door approach.
Right.
The front door opened conventionally and the rear door opened as a suicide door, so to let you into the rear area. And we actually made a mock-up, an engineering mock-up on a 38A to test that out and see if it worked. But interesting as it was, it was thought that really a five-door was the way to go. And I have to agree, you know, in the long term, yeah, it's the sensible approach.
So that the three-door concept, if you like, is that what Range Stormer was?
Yes.
So the what's on display at British Motor Museum, yeah. The Vesuvius Orange three-door.
That actually came about after we pretty much nailed the design for Range Rover Sport.
Really? Afterwards? Yeah.
But it was we thought we had, because it was something new, and there was a lot of lack of confidence, I think, in doing a small Range Rover or smaller Range Rover, because L30 or L322, as it's known, was out, and that was bigger than 38A.
Sure.
And we felt there was a gap there somewhere, but there was still a lot of nervousness about it. You know, could we build a smaller, cheaper Range Rover? Would anyone buy that? Would it threaten the big Range Rover?
Okay. That's quite surprising to hear, because you'd have thought that with, you know, BMW X5, which is not quite as big as L322, mm-hmm. Porsche Cayenne, which is a sports SUV, Mercedes ML, things like that, you would have thought that actually Land Rover would be falling over themselves to bring out a vehicle that the direct competitor in that sector, yeah. Like they did with Discovery.
Yeah, I think it was just this worry about devaluing the main product.
Okay.
Because Range Rover was sort of on a pedestal, sort of really up there. And you didn't want to bring in a smaller, cheaper one because, you know, those folks might think,
I see. You might be upsetting traditional Range Rover customers.
And when you look where Land Rover are now, with Evoque, Range Rover Sport and the big Range Rover, if we hadn't done Range Rover Sport then, you couldn't have migrated those vehicles in the way that has been done now.
Yeah, sure. It was that.
So it opened the doors.
The first stepping stone of going away from the main three, I suppose, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Amazing.
But when we had the clay model, we reviewed it with Jay Mays and Wolfgang Reitzler, who joined Ford Premier Automotive, you know, which we were part of at the time. Jay Mays was the design boss for Ford.
Right.
And marketing was still somewhat sceptical about whether it should be badged as a Range Rover or a Land Rover. And I've got sketches with Land Rover on the front. And that is one of the reasons why it hasn't got the castellated bonnet that you used to get on a Range Rover.
Right.
With the castellations on the corner.
Absolutely, yeah.
They said, well, we can't put those on in case we badge it as a Land Rover. So I had to do a bonnet design that didn't have the castellations on the corner.
Wow.
And eventually we sold it as it was an aerodynamic design for the bonnet.
Got you.
Which actually is partly true, because it did help. But I remember having a conversation with Jay Mays when we were looking at it in the viewing garden, and I had this conversation with him, and he said, of course it's a Range Rover. He said, they'll come round.
Yeah, I think it was, you know.
Was it ever going to be anything else?
Well, no, I don't know where it would have fitted if you badged it a Land Rover, to be honest with you.
It would have smacked of confusion, I think.
Yeah, I agree. Wow, okay. Was there any particular challenges you can remember, other than, of course, the usual cost and time frame of the Range Rover Sport?
That wasn't quite as bad. I mean, working with Ford, I have to say, you know, it was pretty good. Working with BMW was good as well, but Ford, they did a lot for Land Rover, I think, as a company. Range Rover Sport came out. You had LR3 and the new Freelander as well. So a lot of products came out under Ford ownership, and you know, they're very product focused. So yeah, it was good. It was good.
Oh, good to hear. Good to hear. Finally, we touched on this briefly earlier, but I thought I'd ask you again. What do you make of the current crop of Land Rovers?
Well, I think I often meet up with some of my former colleagues on a regular basis, and we often have chats about them, what we like, what we don't like. And I think there are winners and losers. I think generally they're all pretty good. I've got to say that. My favourite vehicles are the Evoque and the Discovery Sport. I think they're, in terms of design, they're pretty much faultless. They work superb. My least favourite is probably Discovery, the big Discovery. Doesn't work for me, but, you know, that's by the by. If I had one thing that I actually really dislike strongly, it's black wheels.
Okay.
I wish to God that people would grow out of it, because I think that nothing kills a car design more than black wheels.
I have to say, two things that I've always thought about black wheels is, A, they always look small compared to silver.
They do.
And B, as soon as they age, you know, the vehicle ages at all, the tyre becomes less black than the wheel and it looks odd.
Mm. Yeah, if you get a... I have seen vehicles like this. You get a black Range Rover with privacy glazing in black and put it on black wheels. You may as well not have bothered designing it. Because you can't see anything.
Yeah, it kind of...
Especially if it's matte black as well. You know, that's the...
That's an interesting one. What is your take on satin and matte colours on cars? Because that's quite a recent trend.
It's a trend.
Okay,
purely,
say no more.
Simply, yeah. Why would you do it? It's difficult to maintain and upkeep. And does it actually improve the look of the vehicle? Don't think so.
I stand with you on that. I don't think anyone's ever made a car change the colour to satin or matte and made it look better. Or
no.
I kind of think it cheapens a lot of cars as well.
No, when you get sunlight on a beautifully painted vehicle, there's nothing finer than that. And I think that discovery that's been done here, you know, when that's all sort of cleaned up and you get it out on a sunny day, it'll look fabulous. But if you had a matte one next to it, you'd think, Oh, gosh, that needs a bit of tea cutting.
Yeah. I always joke my friends who love all the like I say, the modern craze seems to be doing flat grey colours like Audi Nardo grey, and I always point at them and laugh and go, when are they going to put the top coat on? But I don't know. It's all personal choice, I suppose.
Oh, it is. It is. And I think it's a fashion, and it will die. It will come and go. Whereas, you know, beautiful gloss paints, I think, will always be with us. Colours change as well, dramatically. And I think colour is incredibly important. And that's something on the new Defender, I think. It's very, very colour sensitive.
Do you think they've done a good job with the colour palette, the colour choices on the new Defender?
Yeah, I think there's something for everyone. But for me, it works best in the traditional colours. There's a kind of fairly mid-tone green that they do it in, with a white roof.
Pangaea green.
Yeah, and if I had to buy one, you know, that would be it, because I think it looks stunning.
It surprised me it took them until the 130 was launched to launch a red. I thought red would be available from the outset. Yeah. And it does look fantastic in red.
Yes, yeah.
But, yeah. Okay, well, I think we'll wind this up. Mike, thanks ever so much for joining us. And it's been a really, really interesting insight into the world of design. And, the Discovery, I think you'll agree, is an absolute stunner as well.
Yeah, thank you.
You can read all about the Discovery and hear more from Mike in the latest issue of Land Rover Monthly. So be sure to buy that, and we'll catch you on the next one.